I am Nikki Strong. IamNikkiStrong. And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our series on America's national parks. But first, the World Health Organization says it welcomes early results of a human trial of the drug dexamethasone to treat COVID-19 disease. Researchers in Britain announced Tuesday that their study shows dexamethasone cut death rates by around a third among patients with the most severe cases of COVID-19. Dexamethasone has been in use since the 1960s to reduce swelling caused by diseases such as arthritis. This is the first treatment to be shown to reduce mortality in patients with COVID-19 requiring oxygen or ventilator support, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said in a statement on Tuesday. The United Nations Health Agency also said it was looking forward to the full findings of the British trial. The WHO said the additional information could lead it to change its COVID-19 treatment guidelines. The University of Oxford is leading the study. It compared the results of treatment given to 2,104 patients who took the drug and 4,321 who received only usual care. After 4 weeks, deaths dropped by 35% in dexamethasone-treated patients who required ventilators. The patient group that needed oxygen but not ventilators showed a 20% drop in death rate after treatment with the drug. The incomplete results showed dexamethasone did not help patients who had less severe cases of COVID-19. The researcher said the findings suggest doctors should use the drug immediately as usual treatment for severely sick patients. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the study a major breakthrough. His government immediately approved the use of dexamethasone for coronavirus patients in Britain. South Korea's top health official, however, expressed concern about the use of the medicine for COVID-19 patients. She argued that some experts believe that the drug can weaken the body's natural defense system and produce undesirable changes. Other scientists are also calling for more detailed information about the study. Dr. Catherine Hibbert is director of the Medical Intensive Care Division at the Harvard University-linked Massachusetts General Hospital. She said, "We have been burned before, not just during the coronavirus pandemic, but even pre-COVID, with exciting results that when we have access to the data are not as convincing." Earlier in June, two respected medical publications, Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, withdrew published studies about experimental COVID-19 treatments. The data in both were said to be incorrect. However, the top American infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, praised the incomplete trial findings on dexamethasone as a substantial improvement in available treatments. The good news comes as coronavirus infections have again increased in China and some areas in the United States. On Wednesday, officials in Beijing increased the city's emergency warning to just under the highest level. Officials canceled more than 60% of flights to Beijing, suspended its reopening plan, closed schools, and strengthened social distancing measures. The United States has recorded more than 2.1 million cases of COVID-19 and 117,000 deaths from the disease. Both numbers are the highest of any country where the disease has spread.
Demonstrators in Washington, D.C. recently covered a large temporary fence in front of the White House with signs, paintings, and pictures. The art appeared during protests against the killing of George Floyd. Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died after being arrested by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The incident has caused unrest nationwide. Many of the objects and pieces of art were hung in memory of black men, women, and children who have lost their lives in violence linked to police actions. Now, those tributes are being collected for a more permanent home at the Smithsonian Institution. The tall temporary fence was not the only place where artwork has appeared. In central Washington, office buildings and windows of restaurants that normally appeal to business leaders have been covered with plywood. The strong, thin material was meant to protect against property damage that took place in the city earlier this month. Local artists soon began using the plywood as a surface for paintings and messages. Levi Robinson is one of those artists. One of his pieces appears on the boarded-up window of a restaurant in Black Lives Matter Plaza, a recently renamed area near the White House. He described the artwork to Reuters reporters. "I decided to show black medics who serve in the military after speaking with some examples who were on site handing out water." He said the medics began to tell me their stories. Aaron Bryant is a photography and social protest historian at the African American History and Culture Museum. The museum is one of several that make up the Smithsonian Institution on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Bryant is leading the team of museum workers collecting plywood paintings, signs, and objects that will one day represent this moment in history. He said protest artwork of the 1960s civil rights period were often made by professional artists. This moment's artwork, he said, is different. "Today, people are making signs by hand and running out of the door," Bryant said. "There is more diversity in the signs you see." He added, "It's hard to talk about this moment's artwork with one common denominator, but what I see is this idea of humanity and community, people coming together to make messages that will last for generations." The Washington-based Paints Institute helped organize 42 artists and volunteers to design murals in Black Lives Matter Plaza. The murals show images of black men and women Some are wearing face masks. The murals have words like "Let us breathe" and "God is love."
As the school year ends in the United States, educators have been trying to get large numbers of students moving forward in their studies again. The concern is that students who were behind on their schoolwork before the COVID-19 crisis will drop back even further when classes restart in the fall. One of those educators is Tyresha Batchelor, principal of Rosen Elementary School in Hartford, Connecticut. She recently visited students at their homes. Jamie Lee is a third grader at Rosen. Batchelor held her arms out as if she were giving him a big hug when she visited his home. She told him how much she had missed him since the pandemic closed the school. The boy's eyes stayed on his smartphone as they spoke. Batchelor asked him what he was doing. "Playing video games," was his answer. "I like playing games," Batchelor told the boy as his parents looked on. She then suggested he spend more time on his daily schoolwork. "I want to make sure you are still learning," she said. Almost one-third of Batchelor's students have not taken part in the school's online learning program. Batchelor said she discovered many reasons for that as she visited homes. Internet connections failed. Parents were unable to supervise their children's studying. Students did not know how to use technology, and more. Across the Hartford school system, almost 80% of students are at least partly active in distance learning, but less than half of the population considered most at risk are doing so. The at-risk group includes students with poor attendance records, behavior problems, low marks, or a mix of such issues. School systems across the United States have similar concerns. Some report that they have students who have not been heard from at all since the start of school closures in March. Brett Apthorpe leads Jamestown Public Schools in New York State. He said about 75% of the system's students took part in distance learning every day, and most of the rest took part some of the time. But around 1%, he said, have fallen off the map. In other words, they have not taken part at all. At Clark County Schools in Nevada, about 12,000 students missed online classes in mid-April. Officials took action to get these children back to their studies. Even so, about 4,500 students remained uninvolved at the end of the year. The head of the Clark County school system, Jesus Jara, said some students did not have computers, and others had gotten jobs. Batchelor said the education effects of the widespread school closures will not be clear until educators see students' work in the fall. Nationally, research has suggested the shutdowns could cost students about a full year of learning. I'm John Russell.
This week, Germany launched a coronavirus tracing system that officials say is so secure even government ministers can use it. The system is designed to warn smartphone users who might have been in contact with an infected person. Germany is the latest European nation to develop its own smartphone app to target coronavirus infections. Experts describe the app as an important tool in the fight against COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. But developers of the system have had to overcome legal and cultural issues. The European Union has enacted legislation for technology companies and websites that collect personal information. This week, Norway suspended its contact tracing app after data protection officials raised concerns about user privacy. In Germany, a person's right to their own data, even after death, is guaranteed by the Constitution. Many Germans were quick to criticize early government calls to use information from mobile phone transmitting stations to identify users' locations. Tracing a person's location in real time is also sensitive in a country with a history of dictatorships. Both the Nazi Party and East Germany's communist government collected huge amounts of personal information that could later be used against citizens. That's why we have always been very sensitive in Germany when it comes to the state collecting information on its citizens, noted Frederick Richter. He is the director of Germany's Foundation for Data Protection. He spoke with the Associated Press. The new app, which is based on a model created by Apple and Google, was developed by Germany's SAP and Deutsche Telekom. Use of the app is voluntary. It does not use location data to follow people's movements. Instead, the system uses Bluetooth wireless technology to permit devices near each other to exchange information. The app creates a record of which other smartphones are within 2 meters for at least 15 minutes. If users become infected with COVID-19, they can inform other app holders who were nearby at the time that they may have been infected. German officials say the Corona Warn app was developed with strong privacy protections. For example, data collected is stored only on individual phones, not on centralized servers. The Bluetooth exchanges are encrypted to protect user identity. Developers said tests of the app showed it was able to correctly identify about 80% of people's contacts. Germany's health minister, Jens Spahn, called the app an important tool to help contain the spread of COVID-19. But he warned that it should not be a replacement for other antivirus measures. These include social distancing, wearing face coverings, and other methods of contact tracing. Spahn said the app would likely lead to an increase in people seeking to get tested. But he told the AP, "I'd rather test too many than test too few." Some politicians have called for a law to make sure private businesses do not try to pressure the public or employees into using the app. The German government noted that voluntary means voluntary and said the app will keep being improved. Chancellor Angela Merkel's government has generally been praised for its actions to deal with the COVID-19 health crisis. The country's death rate was about one-fifth of Britain's and one-fourth of Italy's. In a recent opinion study, 42% of Germans said they planned to use the contact tracing app. 39% said they would not. The rest said either they did not have a smartphone or were undecided. I'm Brian Lynn.
Our National Parks journey takes us to New Orleans, Louisiana, the city many consider to be the birthplace of jazz. New Orleans is a port city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It holds one of the most famous cultural celebrations in America, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, called Jazz Fest for short. The first New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival took place in 1970. That year, about 350 people attended the five-day celebration. 5 years later, about 80,000 people attended the festival. Today, attendance is measured in hundreds of thousands. The festival's original organizers said the event could only be held in New Orleans, because here and here alone is the richest music tradition in America. And only in New Orleans could you find a whole national park honoring jazz. Today, we are exploring the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park.
The park includes sites important to jazz history in New Orleans. Visitors can walk around the city to see these sites. They include places located in the oldest part of the city, the French Quarter, as well as in the Louis Armstrong Park.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's one you all can sing with us when the Saints go marching in.
Louis Armstrong is one of the greatest American jazz musicians. His voice, trumpet playing skill, and creativity continue to influence jazz artists today. Armstrong was born in New Orleans in 1901. Jazz was just beginning to develop when Louis was a boy. It grew out of the blues songs and ragtime music that had been popular at the turn of the century. Louis Armstrong discovered music early in life. He was surrounded by it. By the time he was 18, he joined the Kid Ory Band, one of the finest bands in New Orleans. In the 1920s, Armstrong moved on to Chicago, and then New York, which had become major centers of jazz music. The trumpeter soon became one of the most famous musicians of his time. In the 1930s, he had his own big band, called Louis Armstrong and His Orchestra. But his biggest hits came later in his life. In 1964, his version of the song Hello Dolly was the top hit around the world. And the song What a Wonderful World recorded in 1968, was his final big hit.
Red roses too, I see them blue.
Armstrong died in 1971. In 1980, the city of New Orleans opened the Louis Armstrong Park to honor one of the city's most famous sons. Among other sites, the park includes a statue of Armstrong himself and a place called Congo Square. Throughout history, the square has had many names. Congo Square was once used as an area where slaves were permitted to perform African and Caribbean dances and drumming. The sounds played a role in the development of jazz. Today, the city holds the annual Congo Square Rhythms Festival there.
Another stop within the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park is the J&M Recording Studio. It lies just south of the Louis Armstrong Park on Rampart Street. The studio operated from 1945 to 1955. Cosimo Matassa, a recording engineer, was the owner of the studio. He recorded some of the greatest jazz and rhythm and blues artists of the time. Today, the spot is a laundromat. But a small sign on the building points out its important place in music history.
Next, we visit the Mint. A mint is a place that produces coins. The Mint started out as a place where U.S. and Confederate currency was made. But today, the Mint has a famous performing arts center and a museum full of jazz history. That museum is the Louisiana State Museum. Here, visitors can see Louis Armstrong's first cornet, a brass instrument similar to a trumpet. He bought it in New Orleans when he was 15 years old. The National Park Service holds live educational performances at the Mint most days of the week. Many of those performances are streamed live online for viewers around the world to enjoy.
Another park site is Preservation Hall in the French Quarter. The word preservation means keeping or protecting for the future. By the early 1960s, traditional New Orleans jazz music was in danger of disappearing. Young people wanted to hear the music of Elvis Presley and other rock and roll stars. Not many young people were interested in listening to jazz. In 1961, Alan and Sandra Jaffe began using a small old building on St. Peter's Street as a music hall. Musicians there played traditional New Orleans jazz, sometimes just for their own enjoyment. Alan Jaffe was a tuba player. He played with what became known as the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. The Jaffes created Preservation Hall to protect and preserve the city's traditional jazz sounds. Today, different bands play at the hall each night. Musicians also still play in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They play in concert halls around the United States. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.